Lord, break the bread of your word among us that we may be nourished by your truth. I once stood on a rooftop between Jerusalem and Bethlehem, watching a total eclipse of the moon. It hung there in the sky, looking for all the world like a round egg which you could touch with your hand and bring down to earth. From that same spot, during the day, you could look east into the Judean wilderness. Just a few miles separate pastures where nomadic flocks graze, from waterless rocks and searing sun, where vultures patrol the sky, looking for signs of death. No wonder this pitiless place has become a symbol for other landscapes of desolation. We can name some of them. Refugee camps in Bangladesh, across the Middle East, on the borders of Uganda and the Democratic Republic of the Congo. The bombed-out wastelands of Syria and Yemen. Others are nearer home. City streets, where dealers peddle drugs and condemn their victims to misery. Individuals caught in a vicious spiral of depression and despair. Abuse of minors. Emptiness within. And the wilderness is a powerful metaphor for experiences we all pass through, which test us to the limits. Bereavement, broken relationships, loss of any sense of direction or purpose in our lives when everything we thought we could depend on disappears, including such faith as we had in God. This is where Jesus found himself, alone and at risk. After the heavens had opened at his baptism and a divine voice proclaimed him to be God's beloved Son. There's no transition in Mark's account. One moment it's crowds and water and the conviction that God has work for you to do. The next, it's isolation in an arid landscape and conflicting voices in your head. Unlike Matthew and Luke, Mark does not tell us what the temptations were. There's no turning of stones into bread, throwing yourself down from the temple, or ruling the world. There are other differences too. They have Jesus led into the wilderness by the Spirit, but Mark uses a much more violent verb. The Spirit drove him there. He uses it later in healing miracles when demons are expelled from their victims. Then, while Matthew has Jesus alone with Satan and angels come to minister to him at the end, Mark has Jesus tempted by Satan and ministered to by angels at the same time. And he adds a third member of the cast, wild beasts. His readers may have thought of lions in the Roman amphitheatre. But their presence is subtler here, because unlike Satan, they do not seek to harm Jesus. When the Hebrew prophets imagined the age to come, they pictured wild beasts feeding and resting alongside domestic ones. So this may be Mark's way of telling us that this is the beginning of the struggle between the power of evil and God's Messiah, which will culminate in the crucifixion. His silence about the temptations themselves is more apparent than real, since they are threaded through his gospel. The Pharisees keep asking Jesus for a sign to test him. The bystanders taunt him when he is crucified to come down from the cross if he is what he says he is. And to Peter famously he cries, "Get thee behind me, Satan," when Peter rebukes him for predicting his coming death. Jesus emerges from the ordeal with a clearer and stronger sense of his mission. No to crowd-pleasing stunts. No to the betrayal of principles in order to acquire power. And yes to seeing it through to the end, no matter what the cost. The wilderness, at first a place of danger and threat, both physical and psychological, has become, paradoxically, a place of growth and transformation. It's not that it can break you or make you. Mark suggests that it can break you and thereby make you. This is exactly the biblical understanding of wilderness. It begins with the 40 years the children of Israel spend wandering through it, falling into temptation all the time. They build a golden calf to worship at the very moment Moses is receiving the law hidden on Mount Sinai. Because like us, they want to worship something they can see, not an invisible God. They constantly complain that their creature comforts are lacking and think slavery with good food is better than freedom without it. In spite of their mistakes, they complete their journey and reach the promised land only to keep making them all over again. Indeed, later prophets, Hosea's a good example, look back to the wilderness years through rose-tinted spectacles as the formative time when Israel discovered her true vocation. Maybe because in their own time of a settled urban culture and much greater material prosperity, they found, as we do, that corruption was rife and abusive behavior towards the neediest in society widespread. Which prompts me to reflect that one place where wilderness testing is happening right now is Oxfam, and maybe in other aid agencies too. News of the behavior of some of its staff in Haiti after the 2010 earthquake has come as a shock to those of us who want to believe the best of charitable organizations. Goodness knows there are few enough examples in the world of genuine human compassion at work. We feel let down. But we need a sense of proportion. I very, very rarely agree with anything Jeremy Clarkson writes. But there's a headline in the Sunday Times today which is something like, before you lynch aid workers, remember the lives they save. The great majority of aid workers perform vital services, often at great cost to themselves, bringing relief to disaster zones and practical help to the poorest and most vulnerable communities. Their work is not invalidated by the perverse behavior of the few, and they deserve and need our continuing support. We must avoid the temptation to think that the whole sector is rotten, so we'd be better off spending the money on ourselves. The more power you have, the greater the temptation to abuse it for your own benefit. We see it all the time in the world of politics and business, and we may draw the same conclusion, that they're all as bad as each other. But that is a damaging illusion. There are many people in public life who are genuinely devoted to seeking the common good, and we should honor them. Take José Mujica, president of Uruguay, from 2010 to 15, shot 6 times and imprisoned for 14 years for his opposition to the former dictatorship. As president, he gave 90% of his salary to charity and continued to live on the farm which he worked with his wife rather than in the luxurious presidential palace. Or the Nobel Peace Prize winner in 1980, the Argentinian artist and activist Adolfo Pérez Esquivel, now 85, who visited my college recently. He was imprisoned and tortured without trial for 14 months for his defense of human rights during the military dictatorship of General Videla. He is a committed Christian pacifist who also campaigns on environmental issues and the rights of indigenous peoples threatened by the destruction of their habitat. Both those men probably know more about being in the wilderness than you or I ever will. No doubt they have their flaws, but they are an inspiration. How is it that some people are able to experience the most appalling cruelty at the hands of their fellow citizens and yet find the strength to bear it and emerge the stronger for it? I find myself wondering that about Jesus of Nazareth, now as he confronts his own inner demons, and later as he is hounded to his agonizing death. And as I wonder, I keep hearing words he spoke one hot afternoon to a Samaritan woman by a well. "Those who drink of the water that I will give them will never be thirsty again. The water that I will give will become to them a spring of water gushing up to eternal life." It's an attractive enough image for us, the spring which bubbles up out of hidden depths to refresh our thirsty spirits. You can imagine how much lovelier that sounds in a land where water is scarce. But is it possible that when everything around us is parched, there are such resources on which we can draw? Jesus in the wilderness suggests that we can and gives us clues. He confronts his uncertainties and works through his temptations. He does not run away from them or bury them. We're fond of saying that life is a journey, but the hardest part is the journey within, to understand ourselves. All the great spiritual traditions teach that this is a necessary precondition for growth. Our culture makes that difficult because it offers so many things to mask our inner insecurity, loneliness, or emptiness, and it has largely forgotten the spiritual tradition which nurtured it. Last week, I found myself discussing with one of my younger colleagues how lacking in resilience many of our students are when it comes to handling stress. We seem to have created a society in which solutions to unhappiness depend more on experts and therapies than in helping us to discover and develop the inner resources to cope with pressure and disappointment. Don't get me wrong, we need our experts and our therapies for all kinds of disorders. But most of us, most of the time, would do well to build up our own spiritual defenses. And the Christian way offers great wisdom here. Its solution is radically different from those on the marketplace. It's open to anyone. You don't have to pay for it. And it begins with the call of Jesus to his first disciples, "Follow me. Hear my words. See my deeds. Learn my way." Not always an easy road. It may take you to places you had rather not go. But through all its twists and turns, it will give you practical lessons in the art of God's love. What that love means for you and what it means for your interaction with the wider world. You are not alone, and it doesn't all depend on you. There are others on the road, and the best way to discover the spring which flows to eternal life is in their company. That's why we form communities of faith And for every moment you invest in the journey, you are given strength to take the next step. That is the work of grace. God's power at work in us, enabling us to go further and deeper than we ever imagined we could. It's not that all your problems, let alone those of the world, will suddenly vanish. It's that your perspective changes. You will understand them differently, more creatively, more hopefully. Don't worry about what you're expected to believe or whether or not you're good enough. It is enough to keep as close as you can to the one who walks at your side and who will never abandon you, even when you feel lost and alone in the dark. The Irish poet Seamus Heaney was once told as a penance to translate something by St. John of the Cross, and he chose a poem about a fountain seen at night. Here are a few lines. How well I know that fountain, filling, running, although it is the night. The eternal fountain, hidden away. I know its haven and its secrecy, although it is the night. No other thing can be so beautiful. Here heaven and earth drink their fill, although it is the night. And its current so in flood, it overspills to water hell and heaven and all peoples, although it is the night. Hear it calling out to every creature, and they drink these waters, although it is dark here, because it is the night. Night and wilderness, both images for our journey. We don't travel as if by day, and the landscapes around us can seem hostile. But the fountain still flows. The light, which is never extinguished, still shines, quietly, persistently, offering each of us the refreshment and the guidance we need to complete our pilgrimage.